welcome to another edition of Expanding Minds. I'm host Derek Davis, and we're continuing our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. As some of you listeners know, I've read my share of Philip K. Dick, and one of the statements from an interview with him, with Paul Williams, recently, sadly departed, he said something that has really stuck in my head since the first time I read it many, many years ago. And he talked about how as our environment, our contemporary environment becomes more and more alive, and by alive he meant sentient, he meant information processing with sensors and cameras and cybernetic mechanisms, as everything gets a little bit more intelligent, a little bit more lively, that paradoxically we begin to see our environment the way that, you know, ancient indigenous people saw their environment, as alive, as a kind of animist place where you're never really sure exactly who's lurking behind whatever given object is in the landscape. It's no longer the disenchanted world that we have come to been at least told is the nature of our existence today, when all the ghosts and demons and animal spirits have all been chased away by the noble march of science, and we find ourselves in a world of merely empty objects and machines. And yet paradoxically it seems like we begin to feel ourselves in a little bit more of a lively environment. And one sign of that is, as Dick put it, is paranoia. Because you're never really sure anymore what's going on. Well, not to say that the ancient peoples were necessarily paranoid, but one suspects that they were rather alert as to the possible presence of agents, whether actual saber-toothed tigers or mysterious quasi-spiritual entities, could always be lurking in the landscape. And with these thoughts in mind, I turned to a wonderful opportunity I had earlier this year to write an essay for the catalog of a show curated by the British artist Mark Leckie, called The Universal Addressability of Dumb Things. And we'll talk more about the details of this show, but it's a pretty cool opportunity. None of Mark's own works are in the show. He made his name with a series mostly of video art pieces, some of which you can see online, which we'll talk about, I hope. But he was really just given the opportunity to curate lots of objects, and the marvelous objects he gathered very much speak to this paradox in that Phil Dickian view, this weird fact that the more we sort of disincarnate objects in our world with technology and media and virtualization, that the more sort of present and peculiar these objects seem to be. And so it's a really marvelous catalog and show, though I haven't been able to see it, and I'm really happy that Mark has agreed to join us here today on Expanding Minds. Maja Daou cannot make it this week, so we'll just bring on Mark and welcome him to the show. Thanks for being on Expanding Minds.
Hello, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I can only imagine this was really a wonderful opportunity. It seems like it's a great thing to be able to just sort of, without being officially a curator, be asked to curate a show along any lines that you sort of want. And when you first were approached with the idea, what was your sense of what you wanted to do, and what were some of the early objects that inspired you? I kind of purposefully held off describing some of the marvelous menagerie of things in the show because I kind of wanted you to maybe think about or present some of the objects that really inspired you and why when you came to mapping out this really fascinating collection of things.
The first thing I actually wanted was something that I didn't get, which was this machine called a Moniac. Have you come across this?
No, I'm not sure about that.
It's this machine that was built in the 1950s, and it basically kind of, it's a model of an economy, and it runs on basically on water, on kind of flues and, you know, pulleys and all the rest. It's this very mechanical machine that basically describes an economy. And it's in a museum in London, and they wouldn't borrow it to me. So that was the first thing I wanted. And then, I mean, the weird thing, you know, in terms of what you're talking about with the Philip K. Dick quote is the kind of enchanted landscape is what made the show really weird for me is that it's about wishing. I feel like when I sit at my computer that I just feel like I imagine or think up things or I wish for things and they kind of instantly appear. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's like a book comes to mind and I can order it and next day it's here on Amazon or any image that I want, any information I want, I just Google it and it's there. So everything just appears like it does to a spoiled child. And that sense of being able to wish for things and they're granted, that was kind of exacerbated by doing this show, because then I had people actually giving me the actual things, not just the kind of images and representations of them, but I got hold of the actual objects and I was able to kind of do things with them and manipulate them. And some of those objects included some of the first ones I wanted that I did actually get was a medieval reliquary of a hand, so a saint's hand that would have contained his bones. That's like 12th century. An Egyptian mummified cat is another thing that's in there. A giant balloon of Felix the cat. Trying to think of some other things that I've got in there that I really wanted at the beginning.
Well, you can even just take that one with the cats, this sort of way in which, like, the mummified cat, and then you have a Felix the cat, and then you have this sort of mechanical demonstration of a cat. And there's this kind of dream logic that is connecting the pieces in the show. And I can only imagine that sometimes it became, you know, quite bizarre for you as you're searching online and finding images and finding out about objects and they all start to talk to one another. I mean, you had your own kind of sort of vision quest through all of these possible objects. And in a way, like, I don't want to ask you, like, what was the thing that was determining whether you wanted this thing or that thing, because it's actually the kind of, you know, ambiguity that's being suggested by these things. But at the same time, you are driven by certain concerns and fascinations, and so what was it that you were looking for in these objects, or what was it that spoke to you about the ones that wound up appearing, such as the example of these various cats?
Well, Felix the cat, I've got a long connection to. I've got a connection to cats anyway, because there's something about cats that are, you know, there's so many representations of cats, and it's not incidental that they've become like the kind of avatar of the internet, you know what I mean? They're always there in some kind of picture form, or some kind of image, or some kind of sculpture. There's cats. So they're the kind of easiest thing to collect. There's two sides to the way I was trying to select stuff for this show. One is that I wanted it to be kind of quite mechanical, like a kind of, you know, I put in an image of a cat, and then I put that into Google Images, and you get like its nearest neighbour, something that looks like an equivalent, or something that looks like it. I wanted that kind of process, this quite mechanical process, but then, you know, at the same time, I wanted just objects that I liked, that I desired, that I kind of wanted, you know. So there's like this very mechanical process, but also this kind of just want, this kind of need to get hold. And the idea that in the end I could actually get hold of them and be in their presence was very exciting. So
there was
things that I wanted to get close to, you know. But also just, I don't know, also just as an arrangement of an image. I mean, the show, I made the show, it's full of objects, but I've kind of made the show so you look at it as a picture, because I kind of wanted it to, you know, I kind of mocked it up in Photoshop first, and I wanted it to keep that kind of collaged, Photoshopped look, even though these objects are kind of real, it's this idea I'm trying to get across of the way that you can, the images are just, what you want can be kind of made manifest, thoughts can be made manifest kind of instantaneously. That's how I was trying to build the show, if that makes sense.
Yeah, one of the things that reminded me of, or, you know, of course, of an example that you no doubt thought about, but, you know, we're also in some ways resisting is this idea of the Wunderkammer, of the Cabinet of Curiosities, which was kind of the proto-museum of the Renaissance, where people started to collect all of these different objects from, you know, travels around the world. You'd have a narwhal tusk, and maybe it was belonged to a unicorn, and you'd have these weird eggs, and then you'd have a small art object or a relic, like this sort of mishmash where things were not organized in the way that we have come to expect. Most museums are organized where we really walk in there, we know there's some kind of rational plan, there's some curator who's responsible for a certain zone, like Greek art or Renaissance painting, or calculating machines if you go into a science and technology museum. But there's this other way of organizing objects that the Wunderkammer suggests, but that you also bring forward, which is this more like, it's a dream-like way of associating things. So when you talked about how some of these objects were just things you desired, you know, I really brought to mind the way that, you know, in these sort of dream states, we move between things that appeal. And it may not be clear what the connections are, but there is a kind of a dream logic that's connecting them. And I think it's something we don't really, you know, I'd really like to hear what you say about this. We don't really acknowledge so much as how much as we move into the internet and as we, you know, move with our desires through the internet, finding connections, discovering objects, images, characters, histories, that on top of the fact that we're processing information, that we have rational goals, et cetera, we all know that. But on top of that, there's this weird dream connection that you were describing, where things are just made manifest, and so do you find yourself kind of dreaming through these networks of information and images?
I guess it's a dreaming through. I mean, I don't know. Sometimes for me, it's something more. I mean, it's not disturbing, but it's and. You know, my level of comfort goes up and down, but it there's something. All right, what really strikes me about what you're saying is that I don't understand, that I can't comprehend, is that it seems like I'm dreaming, my dreams and the kind of machine's dreams, or the logic of the machine and the logic of my dream are getting, they seem kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of, they seem hand in hand. I can't tell. It's like this feedback loop, and I can't tell what's manufacturing what. I don't know if it's the machine manufacturing the dreams, or the dreams are kind of making the machines become more kind of, I don't know, these more irrational or something. But that's the thing that fascinates me about the internet, and that's kind of what I was trying to. I don't know. I just wanted that. I wanted to try and convey that in the show, this kind of weird mixture of the, like you say, this kind of, you know, this very rational, procedural kind of algorithms, but they're creating this kind of weird exuberance in kind of YouTube and all the rest of it.
Yeah, I think that comes that comes through really, really well, and it makes me think of you mentioned in your introduction when you were you know, wandering through all of these domains, getting possible objects. You put the material in these different categories, and one was man, another one was machine, and the third was animals, and we've already talked about cats and all that. And you know, there's a lot to be said about those categories, but they seem really fundamental to where we are now. I mean, not so much in the big, you know, we can have a big story about the development of technology in the modern world, or, you know, the ethical issues with animals and things like that. But I mean, on a more basic level, where we're like, if we're trying to figure out, like, well, who we are, so what are some other images of or models of human beings? But right next door to this question of who we are is what a machine is and what an animal is. It's almost like we're somewhere like in between, you know, and we're like, and both of those models are like more and more strong. You know, on the one hand, we're like, God, we have machines everywhere. We look at ourselves more and more like machines in some ways. We process information. And on the other hand, the distinction between human beings and animals is growing thinner by the minute. So so what would you say, after doing this kind of research, how have you come to see the way in which we understand ourselves in terms of the machine and in terms of the animal?
There's a video on YouTube by this woman called Amanda Baggs. Have you heard of this? It's called In My Language.
No.
It's this really remarkable video. She's like a kind of autistic advocate. Is that the right word?
Yeah.
She's autistic, and she's basically, this video is an argument for a kind of autistic kind of perspective, or an autistic way of being in the world. You know, what do they call non-neurotypical? And what she does in this video is it starts off with her kind of doing this kind of rocking, this stimming, and this kind of humming and keening, and she's touching all these objects around her. She's kind of stroking and touching these objects. And you know, essentially like communing with things, And then she goes on in the second part of this video to talk about how her language works, how she kind of understands the world through this kind of empathy with things. And it's, you know, the idea of autism is that it's kind of essentially non-empathetic, right? And she's basically saying it's not an empathy. It's not about being, you know, unable to be empathetic with other humans. It's just it's a kind of empathy with everything. So there's little difference between humans and other, you know, and objects and animals. They're just all the same. To her, that's kind of what, that's essentially what her kind of point is, or argument. And that I find really kind of where we're at now, that there's a kind of, I don't know, something about the way that we're so embroiled in machines, it kind of flattens things out, I think, in some way. In terms of like sort of categories of how we kind of our relationships with things, do you know what I mean? I guess everything gets kind of networked, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And so less becomes about a hierarchy and becomes more about this kind of I don't know. I guess in the old days they would have called it rhizomic or something like that. But
yeah, I think that that whole sense of flattening and network and those connections, it's all really key. I mean, the collapse of hierarchy, even the collapse like of generational relationships. Like, one of the things that happens in the family now is that, and they'll even use that same language, they'll say that like kids have more robust horizontal relationships. That means peer relationships that are mediated
right.
through technology, and the there's more anxiety about the connection between the parents and the children because the parents are going, oh my God, I don't speak this language, I don't even know how to, like, I'm not in this world, how do I communicate the values that I was raised up in? So there's this crisis of, or a parent crisis, because maybe it's actually something that needs to go, and that we're working our way to a different kind of being. But it's funny when you live without, when you increasingly go, oh, well, I don't really know. I don't really have a hierarchy of values. What do I have? A whole bunch of really complicated relationships.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
And they
become increasingly complex, you know, and strange.
Yeah, and I think that strangeness, that's where there's actually something serious to be said about this return of animism that Philip K. Dick was talking about. I mean, we can think about it sort of playfully because, you know, the phone in our hand is talking back to us, and, you know, the advanced house system knows when the milk is gone, so it's telling us, you know, so there's just some kind of, like, you know, intelligence that's more and more in objects. But on a deeper level, it feels to me that the reason that human beings originally had such an animist view of the world is not because they were children or cognitively impaired or deluded or supernatural, but because it's a way to use your imagination to try to interface with this really complex network of things that you're totally dependent on. You know, and so now we're like in this other world where we're totally networked with all these complex things that we don't really understand. And it makes sense that we start to feel there's a kind of strangeness, a kind of weirdness, a kind of mystery even in these objects that I really think, you know, you capture pretty well. But to talk a little bit more about animals as well. I mean, I was really interested in the way that animals figured in your collection of things. I mean, do you have cats? Do you have, like, did you grow up around animals? Do you have some sense about how your own experience and relationship to animals has changed?
I had dogs and cats when I was young, but now I live in London, so they're quite distant. I mean, I wouldn't have an animal in London where I live. It wouldn't be fair. So no, I don't really have a relationship with animals anymore. I mean, I guess the reason why there were so many animals in the show is that I wanted it to be, I mean, you know, you're talking about animism, but there was something in my head that might have been, you know, ill-judged or misunderstood, but there's something also kind of medieval about this world that we're talking about, this kind of strangeness, where kind of, you know, the sort of fabulous and the real are sort of side by side, coincide, you know. So you have these kind of beasteries where there's you know, there's greyhound, but it's next to a kind of griffin, that kind of. It seemed like there was an understanding in the world then that there was a coexistence between these two things, and they could coexist, and you know, they both inhabited the same kind of sphere. They were from different realms, but they, you know, you'd engage with both of them on a kind of daily basis, and that's how it feels like to me now, that we're, you know, we're sort of, you know, we're in our everyday lives, but our everyday lives is also kind of surrounded by weird figures, weird kind of dreamed up magical monstrous figures that seem to be kind of, you know, looming over us, or kind of we're kind of interacting with on a more kind of regular basis. It's like a kind of surrealism made kind of flesh. Well, not flesh, see, there's the mistake, it's not flesh, it's made digital. But it's kind of there. It's present. It's there on your screens, in your face. It's surrounding you. You know, this kind of strange magical tapestry of kind of fantastic things.
But at the same time, they're kind of ordinary. I mean, that's the thing that where you get into that medieval mode is when you see the way that fantastic things figure, or in accounts of, you know, peasants who have visions, or that there's a sense it's like these things are they're numinous. There's something special about them, but they're also really just woven into to life. It's like no one's surprised that they're going, that they're happening.
Yeah, that's what I find kind of astonishing about them, and just I can never tell if it's me. When you were talking about generations before, but I taught to students, and I can't tell if my age, my generation, is kind of, you know, finds this harder to kind of grasp than you know, youth do. Because it seems to me there's some weird kind of perceptual shift that goes on with this stuff as well. The way you understand, I don't know, the way you understand reality, you know, the way you understand, you know, that there's kind of objects in the show that are you know, three-dimensional real objects with kind of mass and weight and volume and all the rest of it. But, you know, I put them next to 3D CGI objects, and I find it increasingly hard to tell the difference between the two, you know, about tangibility,
You know, sometimes you see objects, you know, and if you start to look at CAD images, or, you know, images of objects that are produced on computer initially before they're manufactured, and then you see some of these objects, you can almost see them as the models they, quote-unquote, originally were in the computer. And, you know, with 3D printing coming down the line, when people will more and more be able to just sort of make three-dimensional objects out of images, designs, numerical descriptions, virtual objects, that, you know, that line, which is already really wiggly, is going to break down all the more. But I think we're going to take a break here.
Okay.
Back and talk more. Just 1 second. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. We're talking with British artist Mark Leckie about his show, The Universal Addressability of Dumb Things. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back. I'm Eric Davis. And further conversations with Mark Leckie. I also wanted to bring up some of your earlier work that really inspired me. The more I found out about it, at least for the things that I was able to track down, your the first big video you did that people really turned on to. And I'm going to mispronounce the first word. Fiorucci.
Fiorucci.
Fiorucci Made Me Hardcore.
Yeah.
This is an awesome video. For the people listening, you can find it. It's on Vimeo, I think. It's totally cool. And, I want you to talk about a little bit, but just my response is it seemed like you found footage of all of these different moments in kind of British subcultural dancing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the UK has had subcultures like no one else in the modern world, and and yet you've drawn these different moments together: Northern Soul and rave, and, you know, this kind of disco and da da da. And it's hard to describe why it's so cool, because you're like, well, it's just a bunch of video people in hip clothes dancing in different ways. But somehow there's something about the way in which subculture, it creates a kind of space for transformation, for some sort of discovery, for some kind of brilliant escape that's collective, that really came through me, because I've spent a lot of my time studying and thinking about subcultures and how they engage the modern world and how they keep certain things alive. So I really wanted to ask you about that, and like what experiences you had that came out of that led you to your interest in these scenes, and particularly in dancing.
That's how I grew up. I grew up with that kind of with that music. I mean, there's a kind of, you know, there's a sort of continuum in British subcultures that is, I kind of started with the Mods back in the 60s, but it's kind of listening to sort of, you know, black R&B or just black music, you know, American black music, and that evolved from like I say, like R&B all the way through to like rave, where you were getting sort of, you know, Chicago, Detroit kind of house. The kick started all that stuff, so that's kind of what it was about, and that was my kind of music. I've never been into like guitar bands or whatever. I like dance music, and I like electronic dance music, and I've been living in America for a couple of years, and I got intensely nostalgic about Britain, and I came home, and for the first time. You had, I made it in 1999, and at that time, you know, you could start to get hold of, I didn't have any money at that time, but you could start to get hold of, like, you know, I had a computer, I had a personal computer, I could get Premiere cheap, and, you know, I could make it. Before that, I would have had to go into an editing suite and do it, you know, do it sort of semi-professionally, but this way I could just do it as a kind of, just in my bedroom. Which is kind of what happened with rave as well, is that's how, you know, that's how rave and hardcore came about, because kids were able to get hold of cheap sampling and kind of, you know, software. So it's the same kind of thing, really. It was kind of led by technology in a way, and I don't know, it was just an exercise. Basically, what I was trying to do was I was trying to exercise this nostalgia that was crippling me. It was just. It just become too much. I was just overwhelmed by this kind of horrible feeling of things missed, of things past, of things gone, and that I'd never have those moments back again. So it's you know, half the time in the video I was editing drunk, and you can hear me kind of half weeping in the background. It's quite a tragic film, really.
Yeah, that's part of what maybe that explains partly why it's powerful for me, because even though it looks on some level just like a lot of people having a good time, you know, over time in interesting ways, there's this sweetness and longing in there that I think is really powerful for people who have gone, especially people who have gone through, you know, intense subcultures, and they've had their moment, and then for whatever reason they get older, or even if they try to keep it going, it changes, and then they're in positions of power, and they're making their money off of the scene when before they were young, you know. I mean, it's really hard to have those kinds of moments, and then when they're gone and you're older, it's you know, there's nothing really like that, especially the way that people come together, like the ease with which people can kind of embrace a collective possibility. That gets really hard. You know, and so that comes through. I'm curious now, do you have, are you less nostalgic in general about things? Or is that part of your, because there is a backwards looking quality to your, even the curated show as well, but at the same time, you're also really looking forward. So I'm kind of curious how much nostalgia sort of lurks about or motivates you.
A lot, actually. Well, I'm always trying to kind of escape it, but I don't... I mean, like I say, the Fiorucci was kind of technologically led in terms of that I could edit this footage quite easily, but also I think there's something about, you know, technology, the internet, it just, you know, it continually spews up, you know, images of the past, and you just feel ever more saturated and kind of seep, you know. A good night for me is kind of sitting down with YouTube and a couple of glasses of whiskey, do you know what I mean? And just indulging myself in kind of, at least, you know, in these past moments. So there's something, and I think something about the effect of that video is to do with it being video, is to do with the kind of quality of the VHS. It's quite most, you know, all of it's basically VHS tape that I got transferred, but it's got this very kind of, you know, it's like our Super 8, you know, the way people used to use Super 8 to kind of conjure up kind of hazy, halcyon days. It's like VHS has got this quality of, that it instantly kind of triggers this kind of nostalgia, I think. So, I'd say, you know, part of the reason I ended up doing this show that I've just done now is because of, you know, I didn't intend this with Fiorucci, but basically what it kind of revealed to me is the power of technology, of kind of how, you know, images are produced, and how they affect us, you know, how they affect me. I mean, yeah. I don't want to talk for anyone else, but they have this power over me. They're just, and this, you know, like you were talking about before, that you know, they have this potency. They're magical. That they're so, you know, they can do things to me in such a kind of, in such a powerful way. And I, you know, I'm kind of held by them, and that's why I make work, because I'm kind of trying to, and half of me is trying to kind of wrestle out of their grasp in some ways. You know, I want to go and live in a, I don't know, I want to escape them in some ways. I want to embrace trees and rocks and, you know, live in the world, not in the world of kind of images. But I do. That's where I live.
Yeah. I mean, there's something, you know, I really appreciate how direct you are about the sort of, you know, seductive, enchanting, you know, even kind of entrapping aspect of images, because I think, again, we too often ignore how much under their sway we are, because it's comforting to admit that you are so easily swayed by any number of images from your past, from the history's past, you know, beautiful bodies, terrors, dreams, desires, all of these things that we swim in, you know, all the time. And it, and like you say, it's increasingly different now with all of our devices mediating all these images. One thing that's been popping in my head throughout the whole conversation is the whole idea from Hermann Hesse's book Magister Ludi about the glass bead game.
And someone gave me that book, but I haven't read it. Sorry,
I have to admit, I have not read the whole book. I've only really read the parts about the glass bead game, which is sort of like laced through the whole thing. And the idea is that it's sort of a science fiction. It's in the future. And basically, the idea that people have then is that cultural production is kind of over. And so what you do as an intellectual, as a cultured person, is to kind of weave together in a creative way the residue, the objects, the images, the music, the texts of the past. And so you kind of play with these sort of connections, and you make a move, like it's like a chess game. They never quite explain how it works, but you're basically making a move with the sort of associations that you draw in your show, where there's like, you know, a medieval text over here, and then over here we have, you know, some new technology, and over here we have some, you know, 18th century image, but they're all speaking to each other in some kind of way. And the internet is like, of course, like it is like a big glass bead game. And when I first got online, back in the early days of the web in like 95 or 96, I found some people who were totally into the glass bead game, and we would play our version of it online. So we would kind of like bounce off each other, like someone would put an image and then you'd have to kind of respond with a text and all this kind of thing. And your show really brought that up for me. And it feels like it's something that's part of the way we are doing things now, but we haven't really articulated it. We haven't really acknowledged how much we are weaving together these sort of mysterious games, which your show in a lot of ways feels like to me.
Well, I mean, you know, the other way I think of it is it's. I mean, that's really interesting. So what you're talking about, the glass bead game, is that it's just stuff. It's just everything just becomes this stuff that you can access and you can manipulate and you can do anything with, and it's. I mean, there's this. I might have come across this through you, actually. I don't know if this is one of your thoughts, but I came across, for some reason, I came across the word fungible. Yeah. About things having fungibility, you know, i.e. things can be exchanged for other things, and it just seemed that there's this kind of, I don't know, that's what stuff is. It doesn't, you know, its value is kind of, it's just in terms of its relationship, you know, its exchange and what you can, and I'm not explaining this very well. Do you see what I'm kind of trying to drive at? Or?
Yeah, it seems like what it's again that same idea of the kind of horizontal plane, the network,
yeah.
Where everything is sort of kind of defined or established already in relationship to something else that it could become or replace or be replaced
exactly.
by
yes.
or
yes.
be overwritten by, and it's funny because it creates the sense like you were saying before about on the one hand you know we're drawn to all these images, we're drawn to all these phantasms that are mediated by technology, and then there's this strong, I feel it, incredibly strong desire to like get with the tree, you know, commune
yeah.
with the rock, as if
exactly.
somehow by, you know, and you have all these people who are doing urban gardening and who are doing crafting and who are figuring out how to fix their bike, you know, there's a lot of people who are trying to like ground themselves by re-engaging with the world of material objects and sort of
yes.
almost as a way to like hold like ballast to you know, as we get pulled into this, you know, virtual you know, labyrinth, and
yeah.
it's such a strange tension that you know, because even when you try to grab that object, it's kind of, you know, it's a little fungible.
Yeah, exactly, you know, it's that tree that was in the Terrence Malick film, isn't it? It's not the tree, but it's, with the show, what I've continued the show into this other show. I've got this other show in Venice in the end of this month, and what I'm showing in Venice is I filmed the show The Universal Addressability of Things. I've filmed it, and I've scanned a lot of the objects. I've got a 3D scanner, and I've scanned a lot of the objects, and I'm making this kind of, I don't know, sort of virtual version of the show that I'm going to show on screens in Venice. And part of this, I don't know, it's like this weird impulse that I had to kind of, once I can scan these, you know, you scan with these 3D scanners, they again, it's this completely magical tool. You just pass this kind of wand over an object, and it magically appears on the screen instantly and in real time. And then once you've got that, then you can do anything you want to it. It just becomes, like I say, it just becomes stuff that you can kind of, you know, it's like those objects sit there and they've got their kind of integrity and their kind of wholesomeness, and you can just pervert them, and that kind of logic. I'm allowing myself to go with it, but I find it very terrifying that I can just I want to say disintegrate. I want to kind of crush the integrity of these objects. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean that's probably what this process, you know, is about, and it's that breakdown of those two worlds. Is, you know, on the one hand, more and more, it's very clear to us in our lives when we are like plugged into the virtual realm of technology and images and the internet, and when we're not. We're, you know, gardening. We're like, you know, buying the food. We're building a hut in the backyard for rabbits or whatever the thing is. And yet those two worlds are like, you know, constantly sort of breaking down into one another. And what you're talking about there was, as these objects become easy to visualize into three-dimensional objects in your computer, and then the other way, as your three-dimensional designs that you make in the computer can be more quickly and quickly produced into physical objects,
yeah.
you know, with 3D printers or with, you know, Chinese manufacturers. And then you get into the whole point that there are sensors everywhere, and that all the physical world is more and more mapped and hence translated already. You know, everywhere you go, everywhere you step, it's always already being mediated through all of these different kinds of sensors. And so it's like, you know, are these two worlds, or are they not? And right. And you're like, I kind of want them to stay two worlds, but it's not really clear that we're going to be able to keep that going entirely. And it's a little disturbing. I mean, I know you just had a kid.
Yeah.
No, a generic question, but always an interesting one. I mean, do you sometimes go like, you know, this child of mine may not only grow up in a different world than I did, which is true, but it's just like going to be different. I mean, it's just going to be, you know, what have I brought in? You know, it's like,
yeah, definitely. No, I shuttled back and forth between her kind of wandering some kind of apocalyptic road and then, I don't know, some version of the Jetsons or something. I don't know what that future is for her, but it's. I mean, I've never, you know, I'm 48, 49, and I've never had a sense before of things so radically changing as it feels they are now. You know, the last five, six years even, since YouTube, what's that, 2004, something like that. It just seems there's this major break. In terms of art, it feels very much to me like it did, it must have, for, you know, the Dadaists, the beginning of the turn of the last century, you know, for Benjamin and all the rest of it, and the Surrealists, that something, you know, some enormous transformation was taking place in culture that was kind of, you know, they had the kind of, you know, imagery being generated there, being kind of mechanically reproduced, and you know, we're in the kind of second wave, I feel, of this kind of increase in changing the way we perceive the world, you know, the way we deal with stuff, the way we kind of, you know, the way we understand our relationship to things, you know, it feels huge to me. So I don't know what world my daughter's going to live into. It's like you say, it's going to be this very strange electronic ambient universe that she's just going to be able to pluck things from the sky. If she's, you know, if she's lucky, if she sits on the right side of the fence, you know. It's been driven by that. It feels like that kind of, that gap is also greatening, is also widening between those who can access this stuff and those who can't. So it's not, you know, it's not some kind of utopia that I'm talking about. It's I don't know what it is.
Yeah. So I'm
this
curious.
This is why we listen to you, Eric. This is why we read your books. So you
can
let us
know.
At
it.
I'm a lifer.
Well, I guess I'm going to keep working on it. You know, it's like sometimes I want to hide. Sometimes I want to go, you know, I want to go off the grid and just sort of, you know, become a hippie in the woods with my books, and you know, but that's just not where we are. And my question for you, we just got a couple more minutes here. You know, when you're looking ahead towards the next work, I mean, you have this really interesting career where on the one hand you have, you know, this materials that have been, you know, knee-deep in subculture that don't look like quote-unquote normal art exactly, but have, you know, really moved through the art world, and you've done this curation, and you've done these lectures, these really interesting lectures where you take ideas, some of them from technological discourse, like Chris Anderson's idea of the long tail, and then you do these really interesting presentation. So you're kind of you're making art, but you're also, you know, kind of thinking your way through these, you know, emerging technological conundrums. And, you know, so I can only imagine that it's like, sort of difficult sometimes to see, like, what's the next thing? Do you keep working with objects? Do you do things with video? Do you make technology? So I'm kind of curious how you, you know, how you see yourself moving forward from here.
I don't know. I mean, it's. I mean, you know, the thing about. I mean, you know, the art world is on one hand this. It's like a caricature of what we were just talking about now. This kind of widening gap between the kind of haves and the have-nots. In terms of Chris Anderson's long tail, it's like the art world moves up towards the head. It moves in the opposite direction. You know, it moves away from this horizontal idea you're talking about. Up, you know, it, to reestablish hierarchy. That's what it's all about. You know, so on one hand it's that, but on the other hand it's like it's a replacement for, well, not a replacement, but it has something similar to what those raves, those subculture dances did of Fiorucci. You know, things can happen within art still. You know, it's rituals can happen. Things can kind of, you know, bring people together and kind of allow people to kind of imagine things in a kind of collective way. So in terms of what I'm going to do, I don't. That's all I see is that art is a space to make these things. That it's a potential space for these things to happen, and so that's. I just want to make them happen. I just want to kind of find methods to make those things. I mean, all of the things that you've said about what I do is I'm just trying to make everything that I do. Part of, you know, I don't know, not part of the work, but just to, or not even to distinguish it as work. It's just to, you know, that's what I do.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Well, that comes through, and it's really different to experience your stuff than a lot of than most artists, where there's a much more of a sense of a canny, careful kind of framing around what the thing is. And. And there is an informality or a kind of, dare I say, authenticity or some kind of spontaneity to the gestures you make, even though they're across, they move in all sorts of different directions. So
yeah,
I'm really glad you're doing that, Eric. What's that?
I'm just not that clever. I'm not smart enough to be canny. I want to be one of those canny. They make money, those canny artists. I want to be one of them.
I don't know, man. I still got hopes for you, but we're going to have to wrap it up here. Mark, thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Thank you, and thanks Eric for writing in the catalog, and thanks for Technosis, which was essentially the reason why I made the show. It was that book's been a real inspiration to me. It's an amazing book.
Well,
so
that's
thanks,
really
Eric.
Sweet. Thank you. All right.
Thank you.
From me here at Expanding Mind, to all you out there, keep your minds open.
Cheers.
Absolutely. Well, I'll talk with you soon, Joe. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Joe Anthony, planetswithin.com. Now, tomorrow I will be back. No need for me to reschedule. I'll be back with the news, and as usual, there's going to be plenty of it. I want to thank you for supporting the show, for your donations, your subscriptions, and telling other people about it. See you guys tomorrow.
Thank you for listening and supporting the Maria Show.